Five, four, three, two, one.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
1 week removed from a flu bug, which left me feeling like the Atlanta Falcons in the fourth quarter and overtime of this past year's Super Bowl. It was one of those situations you can see it all unfolding right before your very eyes and you want to stop it, but once that ball starts rolling, you know there's no way to deny it. Luckily, though, now I'm on my feet, able to breathe, my usual self again, and so I'm feeling good, and this week's episode should be a lot of fun because it includes someone I know all too well, Brandon Tierney of the CBS Sports Radio Network. Having managed BT before, we've developed a friendship throughout our years in the industry. There's a lot of ground we're going to cover this week that I think you'll enjoy learning about. But that's still a few minutes away, so before we do that, let's begin with this week's starting point.
Quiet on the set. Can we please have quiet on the set?
Action! Now, on episode one, we had the benefit of the Entercom-CBS merger to discuss. But unfortunately, in the past 14 days, the February headlines haven't provided as much drama or excitement. What I thought I'd do this week is concentrate my efforts on a different subject, one that I think is beneficial to those of you out there who are pursuing a new opportunity or your first job in the business. First, if you've been browsing through sportsradiopd.com, and let's be honest, I know you have, there are a lot of job openings available. Currently, there's 12 jobs on the website. In my current role, I serve as an advocate to sports radio professionals and as a strategist and consultant to numerous stations around the country. So I have the benefit of hearing a lot of material before it gets sent to a station's program director. When you've done this as long as I have, which now is over two decades, you're going to develop friendships and relationships, and you're going to build trust with people. So what I'm going to pass along today is just a couple of tips to hopefully help you as you're looking at maybe one of those 12 jobs that are on the website or a future opportunity that comes up down the line. So number one, know what position you're applying for and make sure you possess the skills necessary to do that job. Let's be honest. If the only experience you have in life is that you cooked hamburgers or worked in a mailroom, you're not going to be hosting Afternoon Drive tomorrow. Maybe 5 years from now you'll get to that point after you pay your dues. But sending an application to a program director telling them that you work at Burger King and have a ton of personality just isn't going to get the job done. Secondly, and this is to those of you guys out there who do have skill but are trying to apply for jobs just to get in the door, thinking that you'll use that job to get to what you really want. If you're going to apply, whether it's for a producer job, a board op job, reporter job, or update anchor job, be prepared to do that specific job. At some point, if you build trust inside the halls of the radio station and the program director likes you, they'll give you an opportunity to spread your wings and do more. But don't go in there cheating the process and thinking that you're going to use the producer job or the board op job to insert your will and do what you want. It won't work. Ultimately, what's going to happen is the program director is going to say, this person has talent, but won't play a role that I've asked them to play. Therefore, they're not going to get my trust and confidence when a bigger role opens up down the road. The next part is the actual air check process and what you're sending to a program director. If they're asking you for audio, the reason they want to hear it is not just to know if you have a good voice. They want to know that you have something to say on the air. Sending them your voice demo or your best production open or making them sit through a 70 to 80 second jingle of your show open is a bad idea. The first 15 seconds that a program director is listening to your audio, heck, it might even be shorter, you better grab their attention. And if you have your best stuff hidden 5 to 6 minutes into a segment on that demo, you're doing yourself a disservice. Because the reality is, a programmer is getting a couple hundred resumes and demos when a high-level job opens up. As they go through that process, they're going to take the 100 or 200 applicants that they received, and they're going to wind that down to probably 20 to 30 people, and then they're really going to get nitpicky after that. You'll never make the top 20 or 30 if your material isn't excellent right from the start. And if it is, they're going to want to hear more. And if it took you 2 hours to edit the whole thing, you better be able to naturally back it up, because if you can't, good luck landing the job. They'll eventually sniff it out. The last thing I'm going to leave you with as it applies to the job process, pay attention to the instructions that the program director puts forward on the job posting. If they tell you not to call, don't call. Don't assume that, well, no one else is, so let me be the one guy who stands out from the crowd. If they tell you they'll get back to you, don't show up at their door unannounced thinking that they're going to make time for you. It's real simple. If you have talent and you fit the bill, they'll be in touch after your first email to tell you that they like the audio and they want to hear more. If they ask for more and they like it again, they'll likely follow up with a phone call. If that phone call leads to a good conversation, they'll likely bring you in for an interview. And then it's up to you to sell yourself and why you're the best fit for the job. I mean, some of this sounds very simple, and it is, but what you don't want to do in the process is not put your best foot forward. And if you don't follow instruction, if you pursue a job you're not interested in and try to use it as leverage to get to what you want, or if you apply for an opportunity and don't possess the skills, you're just wasting your time. In the end, a program director who's in charge of running a radio station is going to make a sound decision of who they put on the air. You may not like the individual who gets the job, but they wouldn't be trusted with making that decision if they didn't have good judgment. So hopefully some of those tips help you as you pursue your path to a bigger career in this business. But now let's turn our attention towards this week's discussion, which takes place with Brandon Tierney. I had the good fortune of working with BT in San Francisco at 95.7 The Game. Also had listened to him for a number of years on ESPN New York. During his career, he's been in Las Vegas, Detroit, started out in a small town, Allentown, Pennsylvania. And some of you now listen to him nationally on CBS Sports Radio. The things that I would say about BT: a ton of passion, always prepared, lots of energy. He'll tell you this himself, definitely has some ego, which I don't think is a bad thing. I don't think you can be an on-air talent without an ego. I think you've got to live for the microphone and feel you have something to say. And if that microphone was not in your possession, you would feel heartbroken. And that's what I would say about Brandon. Brandon lives for the microphone. He's passionate as hell, and he's going to give you a show. Now, I don't often want to make it a practice to have conversations with guests that run an hour, but I thought a lot of this material was fascinating. And whether you're just starting out in the business or have been around it for a couple of decades, I think everyone can relate to these stories that BT shares. And I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. So without further ado, here's my discussion with Brandon Tierney.
And now, our feature presentation.
All right, BT, we've got a lot of ground to cover, so I'm not going to take up a ton of time talking about your childhood or focusing on your Marist baseball career, which I know you would love to do. But the people coming here really want to know about Brandon Tierney, the broadcaster. So let's start there. Let's go back in time, the first moment when you started to begin to think about sports talk being a platform you might want to pursue professionally.
You know what's funny, Jay? I look back, and I've told this story a few times. I don't know if I ever shared it with you, but it's really, for me, because you do mention Marist, and for me, the most conventional route, and I know you can relate to this, was to become a writer, because the you know, all the debate shows and all the different outlets that are there now just really weren't around then. You didn't really craft in your mind, like, I'll grow up, I'll do radio, and I'll do TV at night, and I'll do this, and I'll do it. It was more like my entry to the field will probably be as a writer. But when I think back about it, I can't tell you how many times after practice, and my dad coached a few of the teams, we'd go to the diner, and we did it every Saturday, and it was just me and him. We would just kind of flip, here's the post, here's the news, and in between, you know, eggs and bacon and everything that we'd eat, we would really kind of do like a pseudo talk show. And I didn't know it. Those were really the best conversations among many with my dad. We would go from, you know, Knicks free agency to, you know, St. John's, Georgetown, Mullen and Ewing, to Dwight Gooden, to Don Mattingly. We would just jump from every single team in New York, and in essence, we were doing a talk show. So, yeah, obviously at Marist, my degree, journalism, all that stuff, and then, of course, as I got into it, other areas opened up, TV, et cetera. But main thing, and again, probably not even being fully aware of it at the time, was debating my dad and conversing with my dad in a long type of format where it was basically like a talk show.
So you go from debating with dad to finally landing on the map in the booming metropolis known as Allentown, Pennsylvania. How did you even land on the station's radar?
Allentown was a crazy story. When people ask me, like, you know, how'd you get to wherever you are now? And they're, whatever I did, don't even think about trying it. So I graduated from Marist, and I've got a journalism degree. This is the one little teeny tiny connection that I've ever had and that has ever worked. My dad knew somebody who knew somebody who at Fox 5, Good Day New York, and they were looking for, it was a paid internship, it was, you know, the lowest level, there wasn't even an entry level, but it was basically, it was an internship and you got $8 an hour.
Right.
And what you do is you go in, you rip scripts, you work the green room, it was for Jim Ryan, who I'm sure you remember the name, right? Jim Ryan?
Yep.
Okay. But I guess what I was supposed to be doing, I really didn't have any interest in doing, so what I found myself doing was really hanging around the green room and talking to the people that were coming on. And I was basically doing interviews there. And now I'm still living at home. Now, keep in mind, this is 96. So websites are still, you know, relative infancy. It's not, there's no texting. And you got to really dig and you got to scrap to get some connection here. So I find this website. One of it was Rick Scott's. And I know you know all about Rick. You know Rick well. Then I stumbled across some other website. I don't know the domain. Who the hell knows? And it basically just listed every radio station from, like, Alabama all the way through Wyoming. And, Jay, I sent something to every sports station in the country. TV, radio. Nobody responded. I remember I got a couple of courtesy rejections, which actually felt like progress. Like, I remember being so pumped up, and this is probably something else you can relate to. I forget the call letters, but it was a station in Denver. It was TV, and I hadn't done a second of TV. Wasn't equipped, wasn't ready, just woefully ill-prepared to do that, but of course they sent them something anyway. And they sent me a, you know, courtesy rejection letter, very nicely worded. And I remember, like, looking at the call letters on the return address, and it felt cool. I'm like, it galvanized me even more, if that makes any sense. So I find this one station in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and they just, by chance, happened to be looking for a morning show co-host. And it was like they took all the ESPN stuff. It took Rome. It was national all day except from 6 to 10 a.m., which was the morning show. And they said, hey, listen, you seem interesting. I spoke to them on the phone a few times. And they said, why don't you come out? We want to meet you. There was one salesperson, Jay. That's how small it was, man. And not only was it to co-host the morning show, but it was also to be the promotions director. I have no idea what any of this stuff is. And I get the job, and I go out there, and I start April, I want to say 12th or 13th. So the job is $16,000, and I'm broke. So they go, hey, listen, can you do play-by-play? At that point, I would have said I could do anything. Yeah, I could do play-by-play. Why couldn't I, right? I had to cut promos every day. And like, I don't even know how to use the equipment to go and edit it for a 30-second spot. Like, I'm just throwing shit on the air, and I don't even know what it is. I mean, I have no idea what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. From there, you just start doing a little bit more and a little bit more, and that's how I started. And it didn't last very long because we were off the air in about 9 months and they resold the station, or I should say they reformatted. Now I think I'm out of a job, and somehow, amazingly, I wind up in Las Vegas, which eventually led to Detroit and all that. I mean, but it was, like I said, nobody in the world should, one, ever take my path, or two, attempt, because you won't get there.
After Allentown, your next adventure was in Sin City, where you worked for the Sports Fan Radio Network. How exactly did that situation come together?
So how I get to Vegas, and again, the infancy of websites, this speaks to my work ethic. You and I are cut from the same mold, and I think because it was a struggle to get where we've gotten, we respect it, and we don't cheat the process, and we protect it fiercely. So I go out after we get banged out of the station. Me and Tommy go out, and we get rocked. I mean, we're just smashed, right? I think my career is over. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. Now, I had two options. This was November, and it was a few days before Thanksgiving. My options are simple. I'm going back home anyway for Thanksgiving. It's 90 miles away. I could just go home and hang out with my boys and maybe go to Manhattan, go to a couple of bars and hang out with my parents. Or I could wake up hungover and begin the job hunt, which is what I did. And I found this opening, Sports Fan Radio Network, and it was for, I want to say, update anchor and weekend host. Now, you know me as well as anybody. I've done updates a bit, thankfully not in a long time and never again, but I did it as a means to get in. I colored outside the line. I basically made up little mini talk shows, which pissed off a few bosses, but it was a way to get in, so you do what you got to do. And I call up the station. Actually, it's a network, but it's based in Vegas. The guy is a Rutgers grad, New Jersey guy. Ryan Williams, who you might actually know the name. Do you know Ryan?
Yeah, he was with Sporting News.
That's right, exactly. Ryan Williams, good, really good guy. Steve Cofield, who I eventually wound up living with, etc. So Ryan says, listen, we're really close to closing the door for this job. We've got a lot of applicants, etc. Because if you could overnight this to me, I said, done. I got it. You'll have it tomorrow. So I send it out, and I'm talking to the receptionist. And I told her, I said, do me a favor. Please make sure Ryan gets this right away. Write down my name and put it on a piece of paper and stick it in your drawer. If I get the job, my first day, you owe me lunch. If I don't, I will make arrangements from 3,000 miles away, and I will get you lunch to your office. She's laughing. She's like, who's this idiot? And I remember Ryan saying, this was right around Thanksgiving, as I said, and he said, listen, here's the thing. I need you here by December 18th. Done. No hesitation, no, well, it's almost Christmas. No, whatever. Okay. If they said be there Christmas Day, I would have been there Christmas Day. So we celebrate Christmas on December, maybe the 13th. I get in my car, and I drive to Las Vegas. And I remember I pull into the parking lot. Next thing I know, I'm flinging around a football with a coworker, 95 degrees out. I'm like, this is awesome. So I was doing updates at first at night, and I was doing a solo hosting, 5 hours on Saturday and 5 hours on Sunday. And I'll tell you, Sports Fan was an awesome place to work. Number one, I was on everywhere in the country. So that's really how it started. And a big break for me, too, there was I started filling in a lot for Pharrell. So the big people, it was Pharrell, it was the Sports Babe, and it was Rome. Those were the main key figures of our network. So when I would fill in for Scotty, I'd be taking calls from Seattle about Ken Griffey Jr. or A-Rod. I mean, there was just so many cool things going on. I felt like it was a real indoctrination to sports radio, and it was awesome.
Okay, so you're finally on the map in Las Vegas, starting to make a name for yourself. And then the next stop on the journey is Detroit, Michigan. Take me through how you wind up in the Motor City.
We're in the bar one night, and you probably know the name Chad Andrus. So I live with Chad. He's one of the two other guys, so it's four of us. And Chad walks in, and he hands us, actually slaps it on the bar, from Reuters, from the AP. He goes, we just got sold. We have no jobs. Let's get wasted. So we're slinging shots, and we all read it. Half the station's there. And what happened was Windstar was the parent company, and it broke off, and it dissolved, and we went from literally being visible everywhere with a great imprint nationally to absolutely no network. And, you know, at this point it was different because now it was like, okay, now I understand. With Allentown to Vegas, it was just swinging away like it was a pinata, hoping something fell and I could grab a morsel of candy and live to see another day in the industry. From Vegas, when it shut down, I was more prepared, certainly on the air. Didn't have an agent yet, but I understood the business a lot more. And because we had so many good affiliates, a few of them were interested in me. One of them was Denver, Tim Spence, who I know you know. And this is another situation where I had to fake my way through. So I do a Saturday show. Tim offers me the job. But there's a little nuance here. I think it was to do updates during the morning show and to host a weekend show. I'm like, Tim, I'm not doing updates. Not in Denver. At that point, that's just not the path I wanted to define. So I said no, respectfully. And I just kept hitting the pavement. And I remember I see an opening in Detroit. Greg Henson, who I know you also know very well. You know, I actually saw something for The Fan where Henson was the PD at that point, probably about 4 or 5 months earlier. And, you know, quietly and tap danced and knocked on the door. And he's like, listen, dude, I love you. He goes, you're not ready. You're not ready. And at that point, Detroit was still in the top 10. And at the time, I'm like, ah, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. To myself, ah, bullshit, I'm ready, absolutely ready. But, you know, being a big boy now and looking back, I wasn't ready. So, and he obviously knew best. So he kindly turned me down, but he said, listen, I'm still listening to you, and you got something. Whatever it is, you got something. So just keep plugging away, I promise you. Little do I know that, you know, 4 or 5 months later, whatever it was, we go under with the network, and now I see an opening on Rick Scott's website for a weekend host in Detroit. And we had a few conversations. He goes, listen, I can't promise you anything. I really can't. He said, I can promise you this, that if you have faith in me, that if you hold up your end of the bargain in a couple of months, if you come out here, things could change radically for you. But right now, it would be Saturday and Sunday, and I think it was maybe $500 a show. So keep in mind, I mean, which sounds great if you do 6 or 7 shows a week. If you're doing 2 shows a week and you basically have nothing in the bank, it's a little tricky. I'm loading up my car, and now I'm driving from Las Vegas to Detroit. And to help give me a few more bucks, and maybe if I have this right, I think to even give me benefits. I mean, Jay, during the week, I was basically running mail to all the different stations in the cluster. So I'm walking into like the R&B station, the country western, the talks, all clear channels, and I'm handing over like inter-office mail. But I'm on Saturday and Sunday, and I walk in one day. Oh, as a quick aside, too, the first show I do, he goes, listen, he goes, nobody cares about the Pistons. Don't waste your time talking about hoops. And I said to myself, whatever. That's one of my favorite sports. Are you kidding me? Of course I'm going to talk about the Pistons. It's a way to kind of endear myself to the bad boys. And I know the Pistons' history as much as people in the city. I mean, you bet your ass I'm talking Pistons at some point. So I walk in this one day, literally to pick up the mail. This is freaking crazy. And I see the guy, Mike Bauer is his name. And I'm walking in, and he's walking out, and he goes, listen, congrats, man. Shit's hitting the fan, and I think you're about to get rewarded. And I said, all right, you don't want to revel in somebody else. He goes, I just got let go, and I shook his hand. The last thing I want to do is start celebrating in front of people. And I walk in, and like 90% of the office was fired. And Greg calls me into his office, and he says, close the door. He goes, remember, I told you to trust me. I go, yeah. He goes, you got your own show. And I'm thinking that I'm doing Bauer's show at night. He goes, middays. I'm like, wow, that's a big jump. I'm like, that's unbelievable. I go, who's my partner? Because they had a 2-person midday team. And he goes, nobody, solo. And he tells me, I'll never forget. He goes, I'm telling you right now, he goes, you can change who you are. He goes, I'm bouncing your ass out of here so quick. He goes, they're going to hate you. They're going to be all over your ass. He goes, you do what you do, and you'll be fine. And I start doing middays. And one of the good things that really helped me there, Rick Carlisle was brand new as well. And I'm on a bus. Terry Foster, a bunch of the writers were on there. Chris McCoskey from the Detroit News, Wojo, guys I just didn't know. So we're on the bus, and the second stop that we hit, somebody says, hey, you said you're from Brooklyn, right? New York, right? I said, yeah. He said, you might want to check home. And this is how I found out about 9/11. Now, and not to just skate over 9/11, but, I mean, that obviously speaks for itself in all of its horror. But specific to being in Detroit, I got to know Rick a little bit on that bus. And so Rick would call me, because they practiced right around 9:30, and I was on the air from 9 to noon. So Rick calls my show one day, and my producer, Marty, female, awesome. She goes, you know, Rick Carlisle's on the phone. I said, wait. I said, but talk on the air. My what? Rick? I go, ah, come on, it's not Rick. She goes, yeah, that's why I don't want to put. I go, put him through. So I'm saying, I mean, in my own mind, if it's Rick, we're going to have a great conversation. If it's not Rick, I'm going to eviscerate him and make fun of him, and we'll still have a good segment. It happens to be Rick, and he's very, you know, Rick Carlisle. He's very calculated, and also didn't get along with everybody, but for some reason, he liked me. And he says, hey, he said, if you're gonna talk about my team, at least get it right. I go, oh, all right, I see we're getting a little loose wire, huh, Coach? All right, man. I said, what do I have wrong? And, you know, he didn't, not that I had anything terribly wrong, but he was just calling the bullshit. And he wound up calling me probably at least once or twice a week from practice. And I developed a really good rapport with him, which I think further endeared me to the Pistons fan base. I immersed myself in the fabric of the city, and it was good. And what Detroit taught me, because you don't get this in Allentown, with all due respect, you don't get this on the national level. What Detroit taught me was the importance of walking into a locker room, having a conversation, bringing it on the air while protecting sources, but also being free to say something on the air, but then have the balls to walk back knowing that there's a good chance, especially in a city like Detroit, far smaller than New York or L.A., yeah, pretty good chance Ben Wallace heard what you said, or Jerry Stackhouse, one of his boys, said, yeah, Tierney said you were chucking again, and maybe they shouldn't re-sign you, whatever it was. So there's a professional responsibility. There's a professional accountability. And I hate to use the term made it, because I still don't take it for granted. But that's when I can say, certainly in hindsight, that was real. That was a good stop.
That stint in Detroit was where you essentially began to build your brand. The next call, though, came from back home. That one has special meaning. The Big Apple, New York. Now, was this when Kevin Graham was running 1050 at the time?
Yeah, Kevin Graham's running 1050.
So Graham has the Detroit connection and is familiar with you.
But, Jay, I didn't know he was aware of me. What happened was Henson, I got into a squabble, and I think he was fired. I think. But I'm not positive. Anyway, you cut it. Greg, who hired me, left. So now he's no longer at DFN, which at that point was, you know, dominating the ratings. I mean, XYT, we were probably pounding them 4-1. Now it's basically the opposite, if not more. And now what they do, and I understand it, you know, they're trying to take advantage of a young guy. He doesn't have an agent, doesn't have a contract at that point. They were trying to maximize their leverage. And I remember they came in, they said, listen, and I was doing well in my time spot, and they said, hey, you know, listen, we really like you. We want to get you to a contract and want to lock you up for the rest of this year, obviously, and the next year. And I'm like, all right, now we're starting to feel really official. And then I see the terms. And the reason they did this is because Greg eventually, part of the impetus behind it, not fully, but part of it, is that Greg then went to XYT. And without a contract, I mean, why can't I bounce there if I want to, you know? So, and I had spoken to Greg a few times while he was at XYT. I mean, I went to Greg's house for Easter when I couldn't. Like, I mean, Greg treated me. I should probably have said this before. Greg was really important in my development, man. But Greg is gone, and I'll never forget. They call me in a room, and it's the acting PD, who was the assistant PD at that point. And how crazy is this? Dan Patrick's brother, who was the market manager for Clear Channel in Detroit, and for those who don't know, Dan Patrick's last name is Pugh. I know you know that. But his brother, Dave Pugh, was one of the heavy suits there. So they hand me the contract, and I look at it, and I'm like, shit, man, to myself, this is weak. And I remember I said to myself, one of the first smart business decisions, and really only true business decision up until that point, outside of deciding to drive to Vegas, et cetera, I mean contractual stuff, where I said, all right, this doesn't feel right. I was going home for Christmas in a couple of days back to New York. And I go home, and I'm sitting on the floor with my dad, and we're having a beer. And I said, Dad, I said, man, I don't know. I don't think I could sign this. And he looks at me. And I'm really expecting kickback, like, well, you know, you don't want to be without a job, and this business is unpredictable, and this. And all the stuff I thought he was going to lay on me, he was the opposite. He said, you know what? I don't know what the other guys are making, but you are absolutely better than that. And I'm not saying that I needed, because I think I was 27. I'm not saying I needed my dad to fully direct me there. But that's one of the last big decisions that I can say that I fully leaned on him on. Because you get to a certain age, and if you respect your dad, which I certainly do, you'll throw stuff by him. Hey, Dad, I'm thinking about, you know, maybe buying this home. Do you think the finance, you know, because they've been there. The experience is important. Maybe at that point I needed to hear my most trusted confidant say, nah, you're better than that. And it just gave me that last little ounce of swag that I needed to go back to Detroit and not sign it. So I tell them, I said, listen, respectfully, I can't sign this. I don't think it's now. If you want to maybe increase it by a year or some extra money, by all means, I'm open to. I want to stay, and I'll even sign a non-compete, okay, because I have no designs to go to the other station. I said, but I cannot commit to 2 years to this money. And now I'm starting to get the sense like, well, if I don't sign this, they're going to pull me off the air. And I said, whoa, you guys trying to communicate if I don't sign this that I'm off the air? And they said, yeah, we're going to have this thing signed by the end of the day. Otherwise, you can't do your show tomorrow. And I just looked around the room. I'll never forget this. It was a pivotal moment, man. Looked around the room, shook everybody's hand, thanked them for the opportunity, and put the contract on their desk, and I walked out. And I never walked back in. So the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News, they get wind of this. So now there's a story or two. I get a call from Rick Carlisle, who was on the Pistons team plane, en route to Philly to play the Sixers. And he goes, what is this shit I'm reading in the paper? He goes, don't do anything stupid. Don't say anything wrong. And, you know, obviously at that point, you know, 27, I'm a little tightly wound, a little more likely to probably maybe say the wrong thing and just let my emotions override logic. And I really, you know, it meant a lot. And that night, again, you're out of a job. What do? You get hammered. Now I'm back on the website.
Do you realize your pattern here? You either kill a format or end up back on a website looking for employment after a night of being hammered, yet you're trending career-wise in the right direction.
True. Now, trust me, like I said, it's a unique dynamic. I would not encourage this route for anybody else. So I go on the website, and I see an opening, New York. At this point, it's WEPN. It's obviously still very much in its infancy. It didn't detail what the position was for. I got wind of what it was. It was 4 updates a week and then Saturday and Sunday host. So I reach out, Kevin Graham's the contact, and he goes, you know, pretty ironic. He goes, I actually know exactly who you are. He goes, my wife is from Southfield, Michigan, a suburb. Spent a lot of time there. I've heard you a lot. I like you. He goes, problem is, this is closed, man. We're not even taking it. He goes, all right, listen, here's what you do. Overnight this thing, get me your stuff. No, I'm not going to promise you're going to get the job, he said, but I will put it on the stack of, I think they were down to, he said they had about 1,000 tapes. He said they whittled it down to 50. You'll definitely get it inside the 50. I said, that's all I could ask for. So I do it, boom, get them everything. And now this is tough because unlike when I was unemployed in Vegas, I'm in Detroit, Michigan. I live by myself, and it just felt uneasy. I really wondered, I'm like, man, did I just screw myself? And this is going to sound odd. It's going to sound like an ego thing, but it's not. And I'm not saying I don't have an ego. I do. You know that. I went to the library because I didn't have a printer in my apartment, and I printed up all of the emails that I got from my DFN account when the news broke that I was gone. And there were about 1,000, and I still have them at my parents' house. And I read them, and I read them because I think at that point, I was a little vulnerable, nothing drastic, but I needed a reinforcement. Maybe that I was good. I don't know. You know, if I want to be totally honest, did I need to a little validation? Yeah, I guess so. So now we're just going through the process, and I'm waiting. Kevin, come on. Kevin Graham, call, email, do something. So he calls me maybe a week and a half later, and he says, for the next 3 days or 4 days, I'm conducting half an hour interview with each of the 20 finalists to and from work, because he took the train. He was like an hour outside of Manhattan. He said, tomorrow at 2:30, I'm going to call you. I said, I'll be waiting. I'll be ready. Pick up the phone. We just start rapping. And I was supposed to be on the phone with him for a half hour. I probably had him on for 95 minutes. I mean, I would not hang up until he knew that this job was for me. And if I didn't get the job, it wouldn't be because I didn't air out every ounce of New York knowledge and everything that I needed to let him know I have to get this job. So I could tell he was receptive. I could tell he liked me. And he's like, all right, we're going to whittle it from 20 down to 5. So from 1,000 to 100 to 20 to 5. We get down to 5. And I remember I just had surgery on my elbow in Detroit. I've got about a month or so on my insurance. And I was lifting, and my elbow was killing me. And I had a little bone spur. So I said, you know what? Let me go and get the surgery on Clear Channel's dime. But he called me. I'm down to 5. And I go and I meet him and Tim McCarthy, who you know very well. Timmy's an awesome. I love Tim. And his concern was, he goes, listen, I know you don't want to do updates. And I go, listen, Tim, I'm not going to lie to you. I don't. New York was the only market I was doing updates in to get in to New York. So finally, Kevin calls me. He goes, what are you doing? And I feel like I'm just praying that you call me and offer me a job. He goes, I got good news for you. He goes, you got the job. And I just let out this monster yell. And he goes, and I have even better news for you. It's $15,000 more than it was on the whatever was on the website. I called my parents that night, and I called up, and I was, you know, a little bit of a down place, like emotionally during the process. My mom picks up. I go, Ma, I said, let me fair. I go, just get Dad on the phone. I said, I got to run something by you guys. I go, I'm in a tough spot. I'm trying to juggle some stuff. I just need some advice. So she goes and gets Dad. Dad's on the phone, and you know he's all ready to give me whatever sage advice I need, and I'm playing along like miserable, and then I just laid it. I said, hey, I got the job. And they knew how far along I was in the process, obviously. I said, I got the job. I'm coming home. And it was a moment that I don't know that I can replicate the rest of my life, no matter whether I go from what I'm making now to $5 million or I'm broke. I don't know that I can quite experience that surge of emotion to, you know, I'm actually... funny, I'm getting a little choked up now as I'm saying it.
Well, that's because it represents a special time in the development of your career. What happens after a while is you gain confidence and a better understanding of your own worth. But up until that point, you're trying to validate your own beliefs that you have what it takes to even make it to the next level.
You know, and the other thing, too, is the dynamic. It's the dad's job to raise a man. That's just the way it is. And I remember early on, it was a little battle between us because... not that he didn't want me to pursue it. He didn't want to see his son get hurt. So to make that call, and I just remember like yesterday, it's just seared into my mind, and it's pretty awesome.
Okay, so now you're home. Professionally, you're starting to make a name for yourself. The station is making progress. They're bringing on big names like Michael Kay and Stephen A. Smith. As luck would have it, you and Stephen A. wind up being paired together by program director Mike Thompson. This is great for your career. You're getting 5 days a week alongside a pretty big name in the business. Except Thompson at this time has a certain vision for how the show should operate, and you don't necessarily buy into it.
You nailed that, man. Seems like you may have heard this story before. Stephen A. was basically brought in almost like as a Band-Aid during Christmas break, and they just threw him on the air. And, I mean, he literally had no idea what he was doing. None. Couldn't take a phone call. He couldn't reset. But he was incredibly entertaining, and he cut through the speakers. So, but he needed guidance. So, yeah, well, Tops, I'll give him credit in this regard. He put me with Stephen, and there, I think in Mike's mind there were certainly boundaries and parameters. Well, he never really defined them to me, to be fair. He never really pointed them out. And if there's no boundaries, then I'm just going to keep going as much as I want until you eventually tell me that I can't, and then I'll go a little bit more, and then we'll just play this chess match, which he and I invariably played for a couple of years. And it wasn't really fun at that point, to be honest with you. But with Stephen, and Stephen has told me this, because you know we're tight to this day, he said, I needed you. So we're interviewing... Braden Looper, the old closer for the Mets at this point. He calls him Brendan. Like, he just didn't know anything but basketball. And quite frankly, and again, I'm not talking out of school. This is Steve, you know, saying this as well in other interviews. If I didn't help him out, it would have sounded bad. So I know this, and I've already been at the station now for 3 or 4 years at this point. And I think Thompson wanted me there to kind of volley and keep a little balance. But as the relationship and the rapport grew, Steven's like, this guy's cool. Then there were, like, no boundaries. Now it's like, yo, Stephen A. B. As people, as we go to the phones, it's like, Stephen A. B. T., what's up? You know, It was an interesting pivotal time for Steven. And I guess in hindsight, I could kind of understand Thompson's dilemma, because Steven was just beginning to really explode. At that point, I don't think they wanted anything that would compromise, in theory, Steven's growth. And the less Steven talks and the more Brandon speaks, then in theory, you know, Steven's not achieving what they viewed as the apex of what they wanted him to become. So you got two guys on the air who love each other, who vibe, and who, quite frankly, put together a hell of a show. And then you got, on the other side of the glass, our producer. He's juggling calls from Thompson. Shut Tierney up. Get him off the air. Tell him to stop talking. Oh, my God. I mean, it was every day. So I had an option. Do I basically ignore that? Which, and to be fair, I'm not trying to sound like a cavalier employee, because I've always been a hard worker. And I, if there's rules to follow, I'm going to follow them. But that was the first time I'm like, you know what? And really the only time that a program director, I just knew he didn't like me. And I was not about to mute myself to appease him when I knew that something good was happening. And at that point now, I'm doing a little TV, I got a little confidence, you know, making over $100,000, first time in my life. And not that money equates to power in every case, but it does equate to confidence and in most instances. And I was beginning to understand that, all right, man, I've been here 3-4 years, not everybody, but a good part of New York gets me. And I'm sorry, but I'm not just going to let a guy who I think has, at this point, in all due respect, a bit of an antiquated philosophy, I'm not going to let him derail me. And I know that that sounds harsh toward Mike, and I don't mean it to, because Mike did some really good things for me, and he's had a great career, but we just didn't hit it off, and most people know that.
Well, styles have a lot to do with how relationships evolve. Despite, though, that bumpy road, you did remain on board even after Stephen A. left. The station paired you with Jody McDonald in Midday, which is a completely different type of show than the one you were doing.
Definitely a different type of show. The polarizing nature, whether it was race or, you know, and obviously you can get that with black-white dynamic like Stephen and I. Not that you can't get it with white and white or black and black, and I think the industry's grown and there's more... a more of a willingness by most hosts to converse about important items. So you have to. You just have to. But the thing about Jody that was very different from Stephen is that he's the kind of guy where I knew that if I just, you know, randomly referenced something crazy, like a crazy finish, or maybe something a little obscure with football or college hoops that, you know, Stephen really wasn't honed in on, I knew that Jody was piped into everything. I knew it. And the thing, the difference between Jody and I, Jody is a buttoned up, and you know this, buttoned up, X's and O's, let's pound the phones. I always felt, maybe because Stephen has a vibe or a coolness or just a youthful, like, energy, more like me. And Jody, I would never say felt like my dad, but it felt more like an older brother. And I also think with Jody, it's very hard to be more bombastic than Stephen. It's hard. And if you try, I think that could be to your detriment. I think with Jody, I naturally ascended, and that's more in line with my personality anyway. So it was more like, you know, he's the sage, more steady voice, and I'm the guy who's going to say something that you have no idea which direction we're going in. And for most part, Stephen kind of had that role, and I would just roll with it and maybe throw my own wrinkle in times 10. But Jody was pretty level-headed in the sense that it was definitely more X's and O's, which I do enjoy. But the thing that I noticed with Jody, and to be fair, I probably shouldn't say that, because I remember when I was with Jody, that's when I had my bachelor party, and I got married when I was with Jody. And Jody was married 15 years at that point. He had a daughter who's almost finished with college now. We were just in very different places. And I think that my approach kind of kept him feeling younger, and his experience opened up my world and made me better, maybe a little bit more whole. Jody was one of the good guys. Jody's a grinder. You're going to have to pull the microphone out of his hand. Jody will be remembered as a guy who worked his ass off, and I share that trait with Jody, and I respect it. But he's so old school, like never uses an ATM card to this day.
Undoubtedly, Jody Mack is a character, one of a kind. Enjoyed my time with him. BT, I want to put a bow on New York, because as important and exciting as it was to your career, the ending with ESPN New York didn't go the way you wanted it to. Unlike Detroit, which ended unexpectedly but wasn't as frightening because you didn't have family or roots planted there, New York was home. This was where your family lived and listened to you. It's where you wanted to be. Now, all of a sudden, the journey you'd been on was coming to a screeching halt after 10 years. Take me through the emotions of that final experience with 1050 ESPN.
A lot of emotions, no doubt. There was a chance for me to stay, and it was in a role that I had no interest doing. And it was, you know, for whatever reason, they wanted to shake things up, and that's fine. You know, that's okay. And to be fair, I probably could have cobbled together, at least for a couple of years, a decent career, you know, salary-wise. I could have survived, for sure. But survival, that's not my mindset. Being in it every day, I felt that I was unjustly punished. And it hurt. Listen, I could try to gloss over this. It sucked. I remember my last show, and I remember my last segment, and it was hard as hell, man. I remember trying to get through it with Jody, and I was just... You know, I had tears in my eyes. It was really hard because it was my city. It was more personal. And I also knew, I didn't know where, but I knew, knowing the dynamics of FAN at that point where there were no openings for prime slots. Yeah, I could have gone there and you know, done weekend shows, whatever. I mean, I definitely had that option, but that didn't make sense to me. I knew that there was not a full-time opening at FAN. So in my heart, you know, as I assessed my career, I knew that I was going to be leaving New York, and that was a little frightening. But I got to tell you, as much as it hurt, you know, walking out of that building, knowing that I didn't deserve that, and I know that everybody believes that, I got screwed. I honestly got screwed, and that's okay. I'm well past it, and people that I worked with know that and knew that. But you got to take it like a man. You got to chin up, and you either retreat. And you sink or you fight and you see what's out there. And the one thing that was galvanizing to me, I was very interested to see what the rest of the nation thought of my talent. From Allentown, you know, to piece it all together, no one knew me. To Las Vegas, few people knew me, not really. This was after almost a 9-year run in New York, and most people in our industry knew me. And I was confident. And I wanted to see if my phone rang. And thank God the phone rang. And it rang more than twice. And I get a text from you and starting a sports station in San Francisco. I felt like it would be a good adventure, a good professional adventure to get out there and see what's up. And I'm like, man, I got to start over. I've got to meet every coach. I've got to go to new stadiums. I've got to get on the air with incredible conviction and believability, and I got to try to win over a whole new fan base, and I don't even know where the hell these streets are and I don't know what's going on. I don't think people realize how tough it is to go to a new city and flip open a mic and say, hey, you know, this is me. Let's start our show.
You go through the same thing when you're the architect for a station. You have to hire people and put out a product that the audience is positively going to receive, even though you yourself may have only been living in the city for 30 days. It's not easy. It's very hard. One thing I've not asked you, which I'm curious to get your response on, was why you chose to move to San Francisco, 3,000 miles away from home, when Philadelphia was on the table. You could have went to WIP. It was only 3 hours away from your family, similar in passion and presentation to what you had gone through in New York. What swung your decision in the direction of the West Coast?
It was a very, very tactical approach on my part. Now, keep in mind, IP, as you know, but just for the audience, is owned by the same company as FAN. So I remember, you know, my agent talking to Chernoff, and Chernoff saying, listen, because they were involved in you know, Chris Oliveiro, who is my boss now, was nationally, but Chris was obviously piped in, and they were trying to get me there. So what Chernoff told me and my agent, he said, listen, you do afternoons in Philly, you could come back and I'll get you some weekend stuff on the Fan. If you would have told me that a couple of years before, that would have sounded very appealing. Money was good. I could have shoved it down ESPN's throat, at least in my mind, going on the weekends and just letting it rip and just sticking it to them. You know, but I really thought about this and I said, man, I don't think this is the right move. Number one, I didn't think it was the right move for Jen. I did not think that she would love Philly, personally. She didn't love New Jersey, to be honest with you. And as a new husband, I took that into account. But what I thought was wrong, what worried me was, if I say, so you go to Philly, you're 100 miles away, whatever it is, I didn't know that I would be able to throw myself to Philly to do the job that I would have had to do, be fully engaged in the Flyers and the Sixers and the Eagles and, you know, Villanova and everything that comes with that, and be so close to New York. I really thought that I would have just kept looking back at New York, and I don't think, at least at that point, I didn't think I would be at my best on the air in Philly, having the wound so raw and so open and fresh from leaving New York. In my mind, the way I rationalized it, I said, hey, if I have to start over and the money is similar, and it was, and I could go to a beautiful part of the country like the Bay Area and do my thing out there and see whatever happens out there, I just thought it would be better for me professionally, but I also thought it would be better for us as a married couple.
Now, that makes a ton of sense. So at this point, I team you with Eric Davis, who's since gone on to the national stage with the NFL Network and Fox Sports 1. The two of you initially were a combination of oil and water, did not get along. Eventually, though, that turned out much better. You guys got on the same page, especially towards the end before ED moved on. But now working with Tiki Barber, a former athlete, I have to believe the experience you gained working with ED has helped you tremendously in the current situation you find yourself in. What did you learn from working with a former player in Eric Davis from a both positive and negative standpoint during that time?
You know, when you're in a new city, and listen, no matter what I said, I really wasn't going to win. Here's the former world champion for Niners, who's, you know, like royalty out there. He earned it. And here's this loudmouth from New York who knows nothing about California, quote-unquote. And I felt like the underdog in that scenario. Tiki's different because it's national, so it's not territorial. You know what I mean? So it's not like, hey, man, I'm on Tiki's turf. Like, I felt I tried to win every debate, and this was my mistake. I tried to get Eric where I hoped that Eric would care about what I care about as much as what I cared about, and that's just not the case. So rather than trying to focus on what he's good at and what we're good at collectively, I just think there were a few tactical mistakes because he played in the NFL and he didn't grow up like a fan like I did, and I think I was expecting him to be on my level with that. And just like Tiki is not, and he never will be, because he played, and he grew up in Virginia. You know, I think at least some of the early turbulence, I certainly think with ED, but we had a few blowouts. You were in the room for one of them.
Yeah, I think I got heated with you guys twice. I remember once when we entered the conference room and had our Come to Jesus meeting, where I told the two of you to air things out, find a way to get on the same page, because you were wasting my time and I was fed up with the bullshit. The other was when I had to challenge you both to improve your relationship with the sales department because you guys were so focused on what you had to do, but you weren't thinking about the business side of the operation, and I wanted to make sure you generated more money for yourselves as well as the sales team. Even though those situations both contained friction, I don't see them as a bad thing. Sometimes people in our business, especially in the sports format, just need to address the elephant in the room in a loud way. Once it's done, then you're back on track.
That was an important moment. There's no doubt about it. I think it took Eric to teach me that it's okay to not know or even try to pretend you know what he knows. Your role's different. You're driving. You're the crazy fan. You're leading the interviews. You're doing so all these things. Because I think that he looks back, and he's done a lot of big stuff now. Now he's with FS1, years at NFL Network. I would think that, you know, if he was honest with himself, that he would look back at mistakes that he made, just like I have no problem admitting that, you know, there were a couple of things that I certainly could have done better or differently, and it probably would have been more harmonious from the get-go. But because he was learning day-to-day radio, and I was learning a new market and all the other things that come with it, it was a little tricky at first.
So the Bay Area run came to a close. That was more than 4 years ago. You've since been a steady presence on the CBS Sports Radio Network. What I want to know is how a guy who shows up at my door at 12 o'clock on a Monday to find out the latest ratings and trends manages then to function when the national sports radio picture provides very little insight to the way you're performing.
It's a little frustrating for sure. Number one, you have to adjust the scoreboard. In your mind, you have to. You have to know. I was just the same way at ESPN. You know, how are we doing? What are the trends looking like? How are we making up ground? Where are we going? What's going on? That's a professional curiosity that was always there locally. Nationally, and I know that this is very unscientific and it's also very subjective, you know, I know that my bosses go on the premise, like, how does the show sound? And I know that they're very unsophisticated for some, but it's not a real ratings thing. It's how's the chemistry, how are the guests, how are the interviews, how's the content, you know, how's the interaction, the social media, all these things that give you a sense of, is it a successful show, is it a decent show, is it lagging? And, you know, you'd have to ask them. I mean, I've been here for this going into year number five, so they're obviously somewhat pleased with it, I would think. And, you know, they brought me in to help launch the network, so they obviously believe in my talents there. I mean, in some ways, a little less pressure, but I miss it. I mean, I do miss that pressure. And, you know, I like chasing. You know, I like being able to look at the scoreboard, knowing if I'm winning 5-2 or if I gave up a crooked run in the first inning and I'm losing. It hasn't changed my drive, I can tell you that. It hasn't changed my day-to-day approach. I still try to have clock integrity, something you definitely helped me with that I never really cared about. So even though I'm not necessarily being quote-unquote rated now in the conventional sense, you know, when it's time to break for all the affiliates, these are things to try to capture quarter hours, you know, if I'm ever back on local, when I'm back on whatever. It's not a foreign concept to me because I work hard to get diligent on that, because you can have the best conversation, but if you don't get credit for it, it's a terrible disservice to yourself.
All right, let's wrap up with a couple of quick hitters. I'm going to throw five quick questions your direction. I want you just to tell me the first thing that pops into your head. Best advice you ever received from a boss was?
Don't spend the day doing what you don't only want to do. And I got that from Pete Silverman, who eventually worked at 1050 ESPN. But when I was in Allentown, he was a mentor. And I called him and I said, you know, Pete, they're changing formats and I don't know what I'm going to do, but I had this job to go and this offer to maybe go work in the promotion department. He said, every day that you spend not actually being on the air is a wasted day. And I never forgot that.
Becoming a dad has made the job more?
Maybe more fun. You know, the craziness of being juggling a diaper or screams or, you know, falling down and God forbid getting hurt or, you know, throwing food across the room. And you know what? My audience can relate to that. And that was a weapon that, quite frankly, I just didn't have in my arsenal.
The most fun Brandon Tierney has ever had working in radio was?
The early days when I was broke and I was just getting in my car and the whole business seemed new and fresh and I didn't know what was next. That was really powerful. Fun, I'd have to say being in studio with Stephen A. every day was pretty damn fun.
If BT were in the shoes of Mark Chernoff, Mike Francesa's replacement would be?
Brandon Tierney. There's no doubt he'd be on the short list if I'm Mark Chernoff, put it that way. Is he thinking that? I don't know. But if I'm Mark Chernoff, I would be. I mean, you want somebody who's young enough to theoretically do the job for, you know, 15, 18, 20 years. You want somebody with passion. You want somebody with balls. You want somebody with knowledge. You want somebody with New York knowledge. Now, are there more talented people than me? Well, that's up to Mark to determine. But on the checklist, I'd like to think I hit most of them. We'll see.
The one thing Brandon Tierney has left to accomplish in the sports radio business is?
Be in a position to truly be successful. When I get hired at New York, right, it's miles behind WFAN. It's on an AM stick, and a bad one at that. Then I go to San Francisco to work for you against the most profitable radio station in America, going against the Giants on occasion, who are pulling 10 and 11 shares, which by far, their numbers are incredible. And no disrespect to the A's, but they have the lowest payroll in baseball with the worst stadium in baseball, and I'm at a startup station, a New York guy in San Francisco against KNBR. Tough job. Then I go to CBS Sports Radio, where they launch, and you know I'm among one of the first few talents that they invest in to help get this thing away from the docks and eventually get deeper out to sea. And it's hard, man. I mean, it's hard. It's definitely incredibly rewarding. Each stop has made me better. I'm thankful for each one. But I can honestly look in the mirror and say, man, I've never been at like a heritage station. I've never been at a place where as long as you do your job, it's autopilot. I feel like every job, it's been a grind. It's made me so much better. You got to really connect to people's soul and get them, almost beg them, convince them to react. And that knocks the shit out of you after a while. But I would have to say, you know, what's next? Maybe to play for the Yankees. I've never played for the Celtics. I've never played for the Canadians. I've never played for Ohio State. And you know what? Someday I'd kind of like to.
Just keep doing what you've been doing. I'm sure that phone will be ringing again down the line, just as it has for you throughout your career.
I want to say this about you, because I did say this when I expounded about on Greg Henson during my stop in Detroit. And listen, Kevin Graham was important because he hired me, and you know I love working with Eric Spitz. You know that. And Eric lets his talent breathe, and Chernoff is there, and he's a legend in the business. But as I look back at my time in San Francisco, I could probably say that you were the guy who made me get even more and made me probably most responsible for any growth I've had anywhere. Your passion for radio is top shelf. And I remember saying this in a different podcast years ago. If I'm starting up a network, you are absolutely in one of the most important offices.
I appreciate that. Checks in the mail. You know I don't do well with compliments. To me, you show up, do your job, put people in a position to succeed, and stay true to your vision, because some are going to embrace it, others won't. But you have to do what you believe in. It's the same reason you left Detroit without anything lined up. You trusted your gut and knew it turned out okay.
Man, you know, most times if you're true to this industry, and it could be, boy, it's a tough industry, and it's been far more rewarding than negative. I mean, exponentially more rewarding. Thankfully, I've been treated pretty well. You know, every stop has worked out. But I do think that if you respect our business and really try to do it the right way, you're going to be standing at the end. I think those lifers, and you're one of them, I think we're always going to be in a position to do our thing, because I just think that game recognizes game. I think radio recognizes radio.
Could not have said it better. Appreciate the extended conversation, BT. It's been a lot of fun.
This is nice. Nice walk down memory lane. Thanks for having me, Jay.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
That was some fascinating stuff from Brandon Tierney. I mean, if you listen to that conversation, from the start in Allentown, Pennsylvania, to the Sports Fan Radio Network in Las Vegas, which ultimately wound up being sold, the first two jobs the guy had, lost both of them due to the company going belly up. From there, he lands in Detroit, starts to make a name for himself, only to receive a contract that he doesn't believe represents his full value. Decides to roll the dice and bet on himself. As luck would have it, gets an opportunity in New York, his hometown, where he works his way up the ladder, finds himself opposite Stephen A. Smith and Jody McDonald before losing his opportunity there almost a decade later. Gets back on his feet, moves 3,000 miles away, begins to rebuild his brand in the Bay Area on 95.7 The Game, and now he's spent the past 5 years on the CBS Sports Radio Network, where he continues to thrive alongside Tiki Barber. Lots of interesting things there. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. Don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter at SportsRadioPD. If you have a news tip, press release, or just a question you want to ask, you can always get in touch by email, jbarrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, at SportsRadioPD.com. That's going to do it for this week's episode. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, SportsRadioPD.com.